Information is free.
The law.
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
We care.
To border
and it shows.
The law.
The country.
You will remember nine you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not go on with it, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Welcome, my friends, yet again to another gut-wrenching episode of Media Monarchy. It's episode 60, if you can believe it, coming to you January 25th, 2008, live from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and also from the Revere Radio Network, revereradio.info. Tons to go over this week. It's Ron Paul in, Hunter Thompson Kucinich out, Rummy resurfaces, and Real ID Rebellion, Israeli spy satellites and Scientology, provocateurs and propaganda, fluoride and FEMA, TV tax and RIAA hacks, Oliver Stone, Ewan Cameron, Music Fly, Black Rebel, Motorcycle Club, and tons more. My name's James. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. It's episode 60, January 25th, 2008. Friends, that was Black Rebel Motorcycle Club with their track MK Ultra, and we're going to get into MK Ultra at the end of this 60th episode of MediaMonarchy.com. It's just the beginning. January 25th, 2008, coming to you live from the Portland Radio Authority every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, praradio.org. And also from the Revere Radio Network, revereradio.info, Sunday nights at 7 Eastern Time. And you can hit me up on MySpace and Yahoo and Dig and YouTube with Media Monarchy as your keyword. And you can get the podcast anytime, iTunes, radioforall.net, or archive.org. 60 episodes out there for you. 120-some hours of my rambling about news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. This week is no exception. And I'm going to get all started with the latest on the Ron Paul revolution, last night's debate in Florida. And then there were five. The Honorable Dr. Ron Paul up there with four other flunkies. McCain and Giuliani. Chuckabee. And the Mormon. So we're going to listen to a little bit of the debate. We're going to hear what our man Ron Paul had to say in Florida on the MSNBC debate last night, January 24th.
Congressman Paul, please take 30 seconds of your own.
Well, you know, I think that we can't run on that program. I think what we have to run on is an old-fashioned Republican program. I can't be identified with this. I'm known as the taxpayer's best friend. I've never voted for a tax increase, and I voted for the least amount of spending, so I'm not part of that crowd. But what we need to do is reinstate Republican principles, then we could run on it, but we have drifted a long way from that, and that is because of all these programs. But there was never my participation in this. I was waving a flag the whole time saying, slow up, slow up. This isn't going well. And here we are. We're at the verge of bankruptcy.
Congressman Paul, was the war a good idea, worth the blood and treasure that we've spent?
It was a very bad idea, and it wasn't worth it. The Al-Qaeda wasn't there then. They're there now. There were no weapons of mass destruction, had nothing to do with 9/11. There was no aggression. This decision on policy was made in 1998 under the previous administration.
Congressman Paul, the other campaigns have said to you that their worry is that you won't stick to your party. If you look at yourself and see yourself someday as unelectable, perhaps you would launch a third party movement and hurt the Republicans.
My biggest concern is they won't stick to the party principles that Republicans stood for so long. And, you know, being conservative and balanced budgets and limited government and individual freedom. No, I have no intention of going into another party. I've been elected 10 times as a Republican. I was from a Republican family, and no, I don't plan to do that. I wish they would worry about it, you know, just in case, but no, I have no intention of doing that, but it might keep them on their toes. But no, I just think that the Republican Party has a problem because we don't act like Republicans, and we talked about this earlier, you know, that we're spending money that we don't have, we've run up these deficits, in the old days, we used to be against the Department of Education, now we doubled the size of it, no child left behind, even the Democrats are running against some of the things that we do, and they used to love that kind of stuff. And it used to be that we used to stop the wars. We stopped the Korean War. We were supposed to stop the Vietnam War that the Democrats started. And here we're starting these wars. So that's why we've lost our way. So I don't think it's a matter of me leaving the Republican Party. If they would look toward what we're doing and the number of people who want to come into the party, they shouldn't be obstructing us. They should welcome. The party's getting smaller. Yet they say, oh, you're too strict on the Constitution. Why should us who believe strictly in the Constitution and rule of law be excluded? That's the way a lot of the people that gather around my candidacy think they're being treated. So I would say, why don't we have a big tent and welcome those of us who believe in liberty and believe in the Constitution? That's what it's all about, and that's what the Republican Party used to stand for.
Congressman, thank you.
So that's the paltry little bit of time that Ron Paul got last night at the debate, even though there's only now four dead horses in Dr. Paul. So the first article I'll hit in relation to this, Paul Joseph Watson up on PrisonPlanet.com, Ron Paul shunned in blatantly unfair MSNBC debate. According to those that recorded the time afforded to each Republican candidate during last night's MSNBC debate in Florida, Congressman Ron Paul was again given the least coverage, being allowed to talk for less than a third of the time and receiving less than half the questions compared with Mormon Romney. So it breaks down to 21 minutes for Romney, 16 for McCain, 13 for Giuliani, 12 for Huckabee, and 6 for Paul. establishment candidates, lavished with time and allowed to ask each other more questions uninterrupted while Paul was shunned and marginalized, despite the fact that he has clocked up back-to-back silver medals in both the Nevada and Louisiana caucuses, which we're going to get to. So this article goes on, but I got a lot of stuff to hit in the Ron Paul revolution, so I'm going to keep moving quickly. However, there's something really funny that happened. And when you first, on first blush, it seems as though Romney was being fed an answer. So in another bizarre moment following a question from Tim Russert directed at Mitt Romney, in which he asked, "Will you do for Social Security what Ronald Reagan did in 1983? And, well, let's just listen.
Governor Romney, you are a big fan of Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. Will you do for Social Security what Ronald Reagan did in 1983?
Raise taxes.
I'm not going to raise taxes. What I'm going to do
is... Well, Ronald Reagan raised the payroll tax, and he also raised the retirement age.
Hold on there, Tim. I'll do it one more time.
Will you do for Social Security what Ronald Reagan did in 1983?
Raise taxes.
I'm not going to raise taxes.
He raised taxes. So at first blush, it seems like someone's feeding Romney the answer, saying, Reagan raised taxes, you're not going to do that. So it seems like it's another Bush earpiece type moment. But I think, in reality, it's probably Giuliani running his mouth, because he can't keep his mouth shut during these debates, talking over people, laughing at people. But that video's up there, so that's kind of fun. It would be funny to think that that was him getting fed a response. So, while you're waiting on your big 300 space bucks from Bush, the big stimulus plan, up on Ron Paul 2008, Ron Paul's released a four-point real economic stimulus plan. Tax reform, spending reform, monetary policy reform, you know, like making sure there's something behind our money, and regulatory reform. That is all up there, and you can read further into that. Then jumping to Huffington Post, this was before the Louisiana caucus, but they were saying that Ron Paul could be the Louisiana dark horse, and of course, he was, came in second yet again. Don't expect to hear too much about it in the corporate media, but even up on Press TV, the Iranian news service, Paul's Louisiana showing a big boost. The Louisiana Republican Party says the state's preliminary results indicate that presidential hopeful Ron Paul has come in second. Louisiana Republican Party Chairman Roger Villery said, "I applaud the supporters of Congressman Paul for their enthusiasm and superior organizational ability." And then we had, and we're going to listen to a little bit of this, but I'm going to keep blasting through the articles and the reference points. Ron Paul was on Neil Cavuto on the 23rd, talking about the economy. This one even got me a phone call from my dad. He said, "Hey, I saw Ron Paul on Neil Cavuto. He was really great, and he kind of laid it out exactly." So I think he's converted. Here's something you may not know. This coming from ABC News. Abortion opponent Roe, from Roe v. Wade, actually endorses Ron Paul. It's not as well known as his anti-war stance, but Ron Paul, an OBGYN by trade, is also pro-life. This is a fact he's highlighted in Republican early primaries as he's tried to sell his libertarianism, anti-establishment ethos to the Republican rank and file. He got a boost at an event in Washington just a couple days ago when the Roe in the Roe v. Wade 1973 court case, whose real name is Norma McCorvey, endorses Ron Paul for the presidency. McCorvey has famously changed her mind about abortion, and now the woman whose court case created current abortion law crusades against the practice. Ron Paul is McCorvey's current choice for president, but he was not her first. She liked Brownback and maybe even Huckabee, but now she's with Paul, so she sounds kind of wishy-washy, but we'll see what that does. Ron Paul is also on MSNBC yet again on the 23rd. We're going to hear a little bit of that. From Northwestern University, they've got an article up about Illinois, already looking ahead to the Illinois primary, citing that it could be the key to his electoral fortunes. We're going to hear a little bit of the McLaughlin Group panel squirming after they all bloviate about what they think should be done with the economy, they play a clip from Ron Paul, and John McLaughlin, who's been a good supporter of Paul, plays a clip and asks everybody what they think, and they all just stutter and fall all over themselves because they can't deal. The Chattanoogan out of Tennessee has a great editorial basically endorsing Ron Paul. Consider Ron Paul. That coming from January 22nd, David A. Shin of the Chattanoogan.com. There's also a video up of a soldier quitting the military to join the Ron Paul Revolution. We're going to hear a little bit of that. There's a negative article from thepeoplesvoice.org called False Gods Create False Hope. And it's about Ron Paul. They say the good news is the huge pent-up public demand for political change. The bad news is that the presidential candidates have made a mockery of the concept of change while ignoring true political reforms. Missing are details about fixing the corrupt, dysfunctional political system and restoring balance among the three branches of government and between the states and the federal government. So what kind of change do people want? The Wall Street Journal NBC News survey last month of both Democrats and Republicans found 24% of voters favor small adjustments in America, 29% want moderate corrections, but 46% thankfully seek major reforms and a brand new approach. When people rally behind false change agents, something worse than being disappointed and having their hopes killed happens. The national energy for real change is wasted. In the end, false change agents protect the status quo political establishment. Hope is replaced by despair for disaffected anti-establishment masses. The worst false change agent is Ron Paul. And they go on to disdain and sling. And that's on thepeoplesvoice.org. But I thought I'd throw that up just for a little fair and balanced sake. We also had, this was funny actually, before Kucinich and Fred Thompson and Duncan Hunter all dropped out, Ron Paul predicted that Giuliani will be the one to drop out. This, another article from Paul Joseph Watson. Congressman Ron Paul hailed a second place in Nevada, letting the establishment media who have tried to censor his message know that there is no stopping us, as he encouraged supporters to donate to his campaign coffers on MLK Day and predicted that former front runner Giuliani would soon drop out of the Republican contest. In a message to supporters posted on his website, the Texas congressman listed the names of who would be competing for the nomination, with one notable absentee, former New York mayor, and I'll add 9/11 criminal Rudolph Giuliani. Another one from StopLying.ca, Rudy Giuliani's losing ways against Ron Paul. This from Dana Gabriel. There's one from the Houston Chronicle. It's actually Associated Press. Ron Paul blames Federal Reserve for economy's woes. This is again when he was out in the last week laying out his economic stimulus package. So we also had a second place in Nevada. We've got an article from NolanChart.com. Ron Paul has sticking power, but how much? The funny thing about this one is, P.S., at the very end, they say, I realize my last article was put up on the Alex Jones InfoWars website, and I'll take this opportunity to state, I think, something, no objection to vigilante justice in response to their sign-waving events. He thinks those 9/11 truthers are out of their minds. Olbermann and Russert discuss Ron Paul's second place in Nevada. We're going to hear a clip from that. And RussiaToday.ru also did another piece on Ron Paul. We hit one last week from Russia Today. We've got the New York Times censoring Ron Paul. However, the update is they've fixed it. Now you can actually see Congressman Ron Paul on their election results page, whereas they kept him shunted out in the other. The Nevada GOP dismissed a complaint from the Paul campaign before the Nevada primary. There was shady disinfo cards sent out about the wrong dates and the wrong times about where to vote and how to do it, sent to basically prospective Ron Paul supporters. And another one from Vegas is Pimpin' for Paul, and we're going to hear a little bit of that as well. There's a brothel that's big fans of the Ron Paul Revolution. So I'm sorry, that was a little stuttery, but we're going to hear a little bit of all that right now. Get it.
I'm all for Hillary.
I like Hillary. I think a female needs to be president.
On Saturday, I'm going to be there, and I'm going to be supporting my candidate, Ron Paul.
Ron Paul. That's the name we keep hearing here. A libertarian congressman from Texas might just have a natural constituency here in Nevada.
Nevada is a very conservative state, but we also believe in live and let live. Don't bother anybody, we won't bother you. And that's what Ron Paul stands for, and I like that.
Plus, Dennis Hoff owns the Bunny Ranch, a legal brothel in Carson City, made famous by the HBO series Cat House. Hoff first heard Ron Paul speak because of cable TV reporter Tucker Carlson.
Tucker Carlson's a regular customer?
Tucker Carlson is not a regular customer. Tucker Carlson took us to the press conference for Ron Paul, Air Force Amy, Brooke Taylor, and myself, and I like what Ron Paul had to say.
I'm at the sight of this unlikely posse at a Republican press conference, kind of upstaged the candidate, but Hoff was sold. These days he's pimping for Paul, spreading the word one customer at a time.
Now, I got to ask you about the sign back there. This is Ron Paul and...
Our favorite Rons, Ron Jeremy and Ron Paul. We love both of them. That's our buddies.
How do they measure up?
Well, I don't know how they measure up, actually. But if Ron Paul measured up like Ron Jeremy, he'd be quite the man.
Let's go into a problem area. It's so interesting. Libertarianism in the Republican Party, very much in opposition to the current leadership of the Republican Party under President Bush, a very advanced, aggressive foreign policy. And they have Ron Paul, very much against the war in Iraq, very much a Barry Goldwater libertarian of the old school. There he is, coming in second today. Will that start any kind of prairie fire out for him?
Well, you know, he's been, interesting enough, Chris, he's been finishing ahead of Rudy Giuliani in most states. But this second place finish will be trumpeted on his internet, and he'll raise a lot more money because of it. He's led all Republicans in the fourth quarter in terms of raising money. Ron Paul is the one candidate who will be in for the long haul, all the way, I think, to the convention. He's never fully closed the door on an independent candidacy. He says it's unlikely, but he refuses to slam the door and hermetically seal it. So Ron Paul is someone to watch in terms of not only the remainder of this primary, but a general election.
And listen to me defending my second Republican candidate of the night. Mr. McCain in third place trails Mr. Paul at 95% of the hard numbers reporting by 8 votes. So he could still, I don't think we can call second place, can we?
Pretty tough.
Is Ron Paul right? You have to deal with the monetary policy before you deal with anything else to account for deficit spending.
You know, Mitt Romney starts your program and he says he's going to do something about the economy. When he was governor of Massachusetts, he had a 0.5% increase in employment in the 4 years he was governor, while the country's employment went up by 5.5%. He left the state with the highest unemployment rate that they have any state in the union. So his words are just phony words. This guy doesn't even know what he's talking about. Romney does know what he's talking about, and he's misleading.
He
has pulled nothing together. He's just pulled words together.
Yeah.
I'm not saying the Iraq war was an economic boon. All I'm saying to you, it does not deal with the problems that this country is facing.
Despite the $1 trillion cost of the Iraq war,
we had 5 years of this war, and the country was booming. The reason the country is going down is because of the credit system.
Ron Paul is considered a long shot for the White House, but in the Nevada caucuses, the Texas congressman came away with a second place finish. In fact, he's beaten Rudy Giuliani in every state but New Hampshire, and his supporters like to rub it in. At a recent Giuliani event, Ron Paul supporters caused such a ruckus, Rudy Giuliani had to head back inside. In the background of the clip we're about to play, you can hear them chanting, "Ron Paul, Ron Paul," and then booing the former New York City mayor while he's trying to speak.
New York, and the reality is that we were, I think, very well in New York, in New Jersey, in Connecticut.
Republican presidential candidate and Texas Congressman Ron Paul joins me now. Congressman Paul, I've got to warn you, sometimes the people over on our news desk over on this side tend to sound a little bit like that. So if it gets noisy, you'll know it's not supporters of another candidate. Does it cause you concern that your supporters are out there causing trouble?
Well,
I would if it's real trouble. If it's, you know, a little rational exuberance, I guess I can go along with it. But they shouldn't be rude, and they know that. But, you know, they feel, I think, like they that I've been mocked by Giuliani on the air and made fun of and laughed at, and they feel like a little fair play, you know, of cheering and using my signs. I don't think they think they're doing anything wrong, but people shouldn't be rude, and they know that I advise against it.
None of this was done with so much as a single dollar of federal stimulus. You can probably count one Ron Paul impressed with that. You see, he is very big on incentives, not so big on bailouts, and very big on explaining the difference with us first on Fox. The Republican presidential hopeful joins me now. Congressman, very good to have you. What do you make it today, first off?
Well, I'm not sure it's the future. It happened today. We don't know exactly what happened behind the scenes, what the president's working group on financial markets might have been doing, but let's hope it's a good sign. But I'm a little bit leaning toward the pessimistic side to think that there's a lot of work to be done before we get back to real growth in this economy, which means that the markets will still be under attack for a while.
All right. Now, you might very well be right. A lot of people shared your view that this perhaps was the proverbial dead cat bounce, Congressman. Yeah. But there is a sentiment expressed here that trying to stimulate the economy through rebate checks and that sort of thing isn't going to please the guys on Wall Street. It certainly isn't going to do much for the guys on Main Street. Where do you stand?
Well, obviously, you know, sending out $800 checks to people who don't pay taxes wouldn't make much sense. And if there's a cost to it, which I'm sure there would be, a stimulus package, where's the money coming from? We don't have any money over here in Washington. We've consumed everything we've gotten. So we either have to borrow it from China or we print the money, which is inflationary. So I'm opposed to that. But even the stimulus we got by the Federal Reserve drastically lowering interest rates, this is a bit of a fiction, too, because the problem comes from artificially low interest rates. We can't solve the problems of a weak dollar by printing more dollars. You know, the other day when the rates were lowered, the dollar had been up a little bit. As soon as the rates were lowered, people said, huh, the dollar's going to be weaker. So I think the dollar's still going to remain under attack because you can't solve the problem of too much credit stimulus by more credit stimulus because it'll just lead to a weaker dollar. And I think they're between the rock and the hard place.
And it makes me wonder why I'm even in the Army at all. All of this is why I'm leaving the Army. It's not an easy decision for me to make. I've been struggling with this for almost an entire year now. With 7 years under my belt, I had planned on proudly serving until retirement. However, I cannot in clear conscience continue serving a government that is not representative of its people and governs in an unconstitutional manner. Why are we the world's policemen when our own country is being openly violated? Why are we borrowing money from nations not exactly our friends, just to spend it on our out-of-control foreign policy? I'm starting to feel like the powers that be do not have America's interest in mind at all. It's starting to feel like our ruin is their objective. From our factories closing and moving overseas to the plunging value of our dollar, America is crumbling. Yet I love her far too much to watch her fall apart. This is why I'm taking my personal revolution and joining forces with Dr. Ron Paul's revolution. His bring all the troops home, non-intervention foreign policy, and plans to put America first again are just what we need at this time. I don't expect everyone to agree with everything he says, but I do hope we can put all our differences aside and join him in seeing that all the troops come home, America is defended again, the Republic restored, and America saved. I do hope to put the uniform on again one day, when America once again stands up for itself, and I can feel the pride of serving America, and not NATO, the United Nations, or North American Union, but our own sovereign American interests.
Critics have called you racist, anti-Semite, and fascist. How do you respond to these criticisms?
Well, that's what they do when they don't want to hear my message. Anybody who knows me personally never says that. Those who put it in print never say, well, I heard him say something like that. Some of this, they say, anti-Semitism would come from the fact that I'm not for foreign aid. And, of course, Israel gets a lot of foreign aid. But I don't want to give anybody foreign aid. And, for instance, the Arab nations get three times as much foreign aid as Israel gets. So it's really a very pro-Israel position. And besides,
I don't like arming both sides of conflicts. We arm Israel. Now we've just sent $20 billion worth of weapons to Saudi Arabia. 15 of the 19 hijackers came from Saudi Arabia. So here we are arming them. And here we are arming, you know, the former allies of Saddam Hussein by, you know, bringing back the Iraqi National Guard. So I just don't see any benefit to us to continue this process of intervention. So some people will construe this as being anti-something, but what I am is pro-freedom, pro-trade, and pro-America.
A lot of people support you, and they feel very passionate about your message.
That's a whole bunch of Ron Paul news from the last week, and it's all up on MediaMonarchy.com. A couple things I'll throw out that we heard in that montage, collage, about the brothel and Tucker Carlson and going to an event. I believe the way it went down is that Tucker Carlson went and got hookers and went to a Ron Paul event, hopefully to embarrass him. But all that ended up happening was they turned into Ron Paul supporters. The other thing, it was nice to see that Paul mentioned the Plunge Protection Team while talking to Neil Cavuto. A couple other things while we're still within the realm of the presidential race. We've got Duncan Hunter exiting the GOP race, this coming from the LA Times, standing at the same San Diego Navy Pier where he announced his candidacy more than a year ago. Representative Duncan Hunter conceded last Saturday that this campaign for president was over. "I will take full responsibility for the failure of this campaign to gain traction," he said. He did acknowledge that his run never gained popular momentum, but he felt like he scored political victory in forcing other campaigns to take on issues he championed, such as border security, the economic threat of China, and rebuilding the military. We also had Law and Order Fred Thompson quitting the White House race, this coming from the BBC. Former U.S. Senator Fred Thompson has withdrawn from the Republican presidential race after a string of poor finishes in early voting rounds, saying, quote, "I have withdrawn my candidacy. I hope that my country and my party have benefited from our having made this effort," he said in a short statement. It follows his third-place result in Saturday's South Carolina primary, a state he had said he needed to win. And Mr. Thompson did not say if he would endorse any of his former rivals. So then finally, speaking of one of his former rivals, in a way. On the other side, though, on the Democrat side, Dennis Kucinich is withdrawing from the presidential race. He's making the formal press conference today, as I come to you, January 25th. However, he leaked it yesterday to his hometown Cleveland Plain Dealer.
First of all, with respect to the presidential campaign, I made a decision that I'll share with you. Actually, I'm going to have a news conference tomorrow in Cleveland at about noon at 11730 Lorraine Avenue, where I will be announcing that I'm transitioning out of the presidential campaign. It is going to be a rather lengthy statement, but in short, I'm making that announcement tomorrow about a new direction, and I wanted to share that with you. And frankly, I haven't shared it with anyone else until this moment, with the exception of my wife, so that you can be aware of the context of my presence here. I am not here seeking your endorsement for President of the United States. And so I am, however, willing to talk to you about the other issues that you address with respect to impeachment. The Center for Public Integrity released a report yesterday, and I would recommend that all of you read it. What it said is that a team of independent journalists surveying the statements that have been made by the administration over a period of 2 years determined that there were approximately 935 statements that were made that were designed to influence public opinion to take us into a war. At least 25% of those statements were made by the President of the United States. Now, as we all understand, impeachment is an inquiry. It's not removal from office. I believe we're losing our country to war based on lies, destruction of our civil liberties, to massive debt, borrowing money from China to fund this war. the Cleveland area alone by the end of this year, we've spent over $1 billion. We've contributed over $1 billion to this war. Our whole domestic agenda is being shredded. And the only thing that holds a republic together is the truth. If we don't have the truth, then there's no way to proceed. And if we're misled into a war that has cost the lives of 4,000 of our young men and women, the lives of over 1 million innocent Iraqis, a cost that could go to $2 trillion, I think that Congress has a constitutional responsibility to proceed with an inquiry, which is what an impeachment is. Yesterday, I met with a group of members from the Judiciary Committee. There are now 9 members of the Judiciary Committee who support the resolution of impeachment with respect to the Vice President. And I do not believe that there will be an impeachment this year. I don't think that will happen. But I do think that the questions relating to an inquiry of both the President and the Vice President are important so that our nation has a real understanding of the effort that was made, a consistent effort, to mislead the people into supporting war.
So that was Dennis Kucinich speaking yesterday to the Cleveland Plain Dealer, announcing his withdrawal from the 2008 presidential race. Sad to see him go. He's the only other worthwhile candidate in the whole mess. It was him and Dr. Paul, so who knows? Perhaps they'll join forces later. But we're going to get out of the world of the election and get into a little bit of space war, private military contractors, future combat system, NORTHCOM, Noble Resolve, and all that good stuff. So coming from spacewar.com, a report from the AFP, a poll says that both U.S. and Russian citizens want a weapons-free outer space. Most Americans and Russians want their governments to ensure a weapons-free outer space and would back a treaty underpinning the move. A poll showed Thursday 78% of Americans and 67% of Russians said their leadership should refrain from deploying any weapons in space as long as no other country does so. This all according to a poll done by worldpublicopinion.org with the links there for you. 80% of Americans and 72% of Russians also favor a new treaty banning all weapons in space, said the survey conducted with the Center for International and Security Studies at the University of Maryland. An overwhelming majority of Americans and Russians, 86% each, put a high priority on preventing an arms race in space. What's striking is the robust consensus among Russians as well as Americans, and among Republicans as well as Democrats, that space should not be an arena for the major powers to compete for military advantage, said Stephen Cull, director of worldpublicopinion.org, in a statement. So I have the links up to worldpublicopinion.org. You can download the PDF of the full report and their questionnaire and their methodology and all that's there. Americans and Russians on space weapons. Speaking of Russia, this coming again from Press TV, Iran's state news service, I believe. U.S. hires fake Soviet weapons experts, a plan drawn by Washington to divert Soviet Union weapons technology away from other countries, has proven to be no more than a U.S. scam. The U.S. Department of Energy had set up a program after the fall of the USSR to keep newly impoverished Soviet scientists from immigrating to wealthy countries hostile to the U.S. Although the U.S. considered the program to be a triumph, a congressional investigation found that scientists had been employed who were not really weapons experts or are too young to have been working in Soviet nuclear arms programs. The investigation also raised questions about the program's $30 million budget this year, saying it might be indirectly helping the Russia-Iran nuclear fuel deal. The scam has deeply worried members of Congress who believe the program may have outlived its usefulness as Russia's circumstances have changed. According to the New York Times, nearly $309 million has been spent on the program since its inception in 1994. And so, said New York Times article written by Matthew Wald, hiring of Soviet scientists have strayed from aim, audit says. an American effort set up after the fall of the Soviet Union to hire its former weapons scientists to keep them from selling their skills to nations seeking nuclear, biological, or chemical weapons, is now paying people who were never weapons scientists or are too young to have worked in the old Soviet program. Does that sound familiar? Sounds a little like Operation Paperclip, where we brought over Nazis because we didn't want them to fall into the hands of the Soviets. EE Times has a report, George Leopold writes, Army's future combat systems plagued by software problems. We've discussed Army future combat systems on the show many times before. Dateline Washington, congressional auditors are reportedly questioning the exploding scale of software development required to field the U.S. Army's future combat system. In a report in Thursday, January 24th's edition of the Washington Post, officials were quoted with the Congressional Government Accountability Office, GAO, as saying the Army underestimated the size of the software effort. The amount of software code for the future combat system has reportedly doubled since development began in 2003. According to the GAO, the program has grown from 33.7 million lines of code to 63.8 million. The next largest DoD software development project is the Joint Strike Fighter, which is about 23 million lines of code, and I got the links there for you to read about. GAO and FCS and JSF. According to the Washington Post story, investigators said the software portion of the future combat system was started prematurely and that the Army and prime contractor Boeing didn't really understand the requirements. But that won't stop them. Jumping to the fascist mouth, if you go to DHS.gov, Homeland Stupidity, they're telling you all about how they're now collecting all 10 fingerprints from international visitors at Boston's Logan International Airport. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security announced that it has begun collecting additional fingerprints from international visitors arriving at Boston Logan International Airport. The change is part of the department's upgrade from 2 to 10 fingerprint collection to enhance security and facilitate legitimate travel by more accurately and efficiently establishing and verifying visitors' identities. Biometrics have revolutionized our ability to prevent dangerous people from entering the United States since 2004. Our upgrade to 10 fingerprint collection builds on our success, enabling us to focus more attention on stopping potential security risks, said Robert Mockney, director of U.S. Visit. So yes, they'll be fingerprinting small children and grandmas, all for your safety. An interesting link in that story. You can jump over to cooperativeresearch.org, the complete 9/11 timeline from Paul Thompson, and hit the profile for Logan Airport, because there, you know, some of them hijackers on 9/11 supposedly went out of there. And so you can see all those entries, such as airport later used by 10 hijackers has poor security record and lacks surveillance cameras, that all the way back to 91. FAA finds repeated security violations, that from 97 to 99. September 9th, Muhammad Atta witnessed behaving suspiciously at Logan Airport. But I thought he was hanging out with hookers in Florida. That's all there. I'm not going to dive into it. But you can read all about Atta and Logan Airport. Moving right along to another Pentagon lethal weapon, the U.S. Department of Defense's wide-ranging Warfighter Enhancement Program is preparing grounds for the most lethal weapon ever, Pentagon's the Psychological Kevlar Act of 2007. And I got the link to GovTrack, and you can read about that. The Psychological Kevlar Act of 2007 puts forward the idea of using different drugs to insulate combat soldiers from the stressful psychological element of killing. The move not only desensitizes them to the horrendous aspects of war, but also maximizes soldiers' lethality by bypassing their moral autonomy. Analyst Penny Coleman criticizes Pentagon's attempts to peddle magic pills to chase away the horrors of war, saying, quote, "The neurological and genetic reengineering of soldiers' minds and bodies is aimed at creating what the Pentagon calls iron-bodied and iron-willed personnel, tireless, relentless, remorseless, and unstoppable." Barry Romo, a national coordinator for Vietnam Veterans Against the War, also denounces the plan, saying, quote, "That's the devil pill. That's the monster pill. The anti-morality pill. That's the pill that can make men and women do anything and think they can get away with it. Even if it doesn't work, what's scary is that a young soldier could believe it will." The Psychological Kevlar Act of 2007. Good God, what's next? Oh, I know what's next. It's more from the Pentagon. This coming from Danger Room on Wired.com. Pentagon is also exploring human fear chemicals, scare sensors, and contagious stress. American military researchers are working to uncover and harness the most terrifying chemical imaginable, that most primal odor, the scent of fear. Pheromones are chemically released by animals as signal to their own kind, for sex, for territorial marking, and more. They're often detected in the olfactory membranes, but there's more to pheromones than attraction. Many animals have an alarm pheromone, which is used to signal danger. Aphids, for example, use it to cause their fellow lice to flee. Now the U.S. Army is trying to track down and harness people's smell of fear. The military has backed a study on the, quote, "identification and isolation of human alarm pheromones," which focused on the preliminary identification of steroids of interest in human fear sweat. The so-called skydiving protocol was the researchers' method of choice. On its own, the alarm pheromone probably would not do much, but given an external trigger, such as a loud noise, it could influence people to start stampeding like spooked cattle. Then again, the bee alarm pheromone triggers attack rather than flight. And the Viennese study suggested something similar may apply to humans, or are there multiple pheromones involved? Whatever is going on, this research is likely to uncover some novel and powerful ways of manipulating human behavior. Some of the military research complex have been down this road before. Remember the so-called gay bomb that would make enemy combatants irresistibly attracted to one another? Speaking of which, all those websites advertising pheromones to make it irresistible to the opposite sex haven't actually got many decent studies to back them up, a topic that was recently explored by Noah Shachtman of Danger Room on the Wired.com blog. And there's a link up you can read from the Defense Technical Information Center, DTIC.mil. You can read about their study of the identification and isolation of human alarm pheromones. And now, it's the return of Noble Resolve. That's right, for those of us here in Oregon. Noble Resolve is not over. It's coming back again under the title DHS to Unveil New Disaster Response Plan, is where you'll find this info. The Bush administration is set to announce an overhaul of the nation's emergency response blueprint Tuesday, streamlining a chain of command that failed after Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Sources familiar with the plan said yesterday, "I now realize this is talking about FEMA regaining its power. I haven't gotten to the bit about Noble Resolve just yet." So anyway, Dateline, Washington, January 19th. This is about FEMA regaining their power, as if they ever really lost any. I've got the link up to the FEMA entry on sourcewatch.org. It's a, quote, "former independent agency that became part of the new Homeland Security and did such a great job." Now, what's interesting is that FEMA has been around for quite a long time. And there's a link up to theforbiddenknowledge.com. It's kind of a defunct website, but they have a list of probably not exactly current executive orders. But FEMA, some people have referred to it as the secret government of the United States. It's not an elected body. It does not involve itself in public disclosures, and it even has a quasi-secret budget in the billions of dollars. So, in the Carter era, when FEMA was set up, there was a whole rack of executive orders, and the link is up there and you can read all about them, but I'll just tell you what some of them say, like Executive Order 10990 allows the government to take over all modes of transportation and control of highways and seaports. We've got seize and control communications media, take over all electrical power, gas, petroleum, fuels, and minerals, take over all food resources and farms, mobilize civilians into work brigades under government supervision, take over all health, education, and welfare functions, designates the Postmaster General to operate a national registration of all persons, allows the government to take over all airports and aircraft, including commercial aircraft, allows the Housing and Finance Authority to relocate communities, build new housing with public funds, designate areas to be abandoned, and establish new locations for populations. Also allows government to take over railroads, inland waterways, and public storage facilities, and also specifies the responsibility of the Office of Emergency Planning and gives authorization to put all executive orders into effect in times of increased international tension and economic or financial crisis. So that's basically anything. And so you can hit up all those times and all those instances of executive orders related to the Federal Emergency Management Agency. You can also see how it ties into Rex 84, the Readiness Exercise 1984. That's continuity of government. Now, we're to Noble Resolve. This coming to my attention from Amanda Rogers at RogueGovernment.com. But the article originally comes from WashingtonTechnology.com. Northcom to run a computer disaster drill. The U.S. Joint Forces Command and Northern Command are planning a series of computer-based disaster drills with four states this year as part of their Noble Resolve 2008 preparedness exercises. The drills are intended to enhance military support during and after natural disasters, accidents, and terrorist attacks. The participating states are Indiana, Oregon, Texas, and Virginia.
U.S. Joint Forces Command and U.S. Northern Command, or NORTHCOM, recently began planning for Noble Resolve 08, a series of events designed to enhance homeland defense measures and military support during natural or man-made disasters. Noble Resolve, sponsored by USJFCOM but in support of NORTHCOM, is an experimentation campaign supporting NORTHCOM's effort to develop solutions and capabilities for the U.S. to better defend the homeland and improve response to a crisis. Navy Rear Admiral Dan Davenport, Director of the Joint Concept Development and Experimentation Directorate, explained USJFCOM's role in the event.
Our particular role, especially for this event, is that we design, conduct the experiment. We will provide the distributed experimentation environment. We generate a scenario and we distribute it out to all the participants. So we don't have to bring everybody to Suffolk to do the experiment.
Noble Resolve will use intricate computer-based models and long-distance virtual connections to provide the environment for participants to make decisions and work together as if they would in the case of a real crisis.
There it is. Straight from the Red Team's mouth. Joint Forces Command. So, yeah, just when you thought it was safe, Noble Resolve is coming back to Oregon. So there's the link up to NORTHCOM, one of the organizations running the drill. U.S. NORTHCOM is headquartered at Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado Springs, Colorado, and was established in 2002 by the DOD to consolidate under a single unified command existing missions that were previously executed by other military organizations. So it's a big smashing together of things. So it's jfcom.mil, and you can read about their readying for Noble Resolve 08, and that's where I got that podcast. Straight from the fascist mouth. There's also the Joint Forces Command entry on SourceWatch. They're headquartered in Norfolk, Virginia, and they are one of the nine unified commands in the DOD, and you can read all about that. However, coming out of Brooklyn this last week, we had a big terror bust. So there's a few articles, all four from the big New York newspapers. First, we've got New York Daily News. Bomb-making factory found in Brooklyn apartment of Columbia professor. Police stumbled upon a bomb-making factory Sunday in the home of a Columbia professor who specializes in the spread of infectious disease and are investigating whether he and his roommate have terror ties. And I'll just mention, you should probably investigate whether they have FBI provocateur false flag Mossad ties. Cops evacuated the Brooklyn Heights neighborhood around the Remsen St., or rather street, home of Michael Klatz, C-L-A-T-T-S, a medical anthropologist, after finding seven pipe bombs fitted with fuses in his flat. The frightening cache was discovered almost by accident. Ivalo Ivanov, The man living with Klatz accidentally shot off the tip of his left index finger and sought police help in the street at about a quarter after one in the morning. When investigators went to the 37-year-old Ivanov's apartment, they found the bombs already capped on both ends and filled with powder. One of the pipe bombs was inserted into a Nerf football. They also found a 9mm handgun, two ammo magazines, 12-gauge shotgun, silencer, bulletproof vest, crossbow, bomb-making equipment, drill, threading machine. Investigators with the NYPD FBI were questioning Ivanov, a native of Bulgaria, to determine whether he had any terrorism or Russian mafia connections. Russian mafia aren't fazed by getting a fingertip shot off, and they certainly don't go to the cops for help, the source said. Neither man so far has popped up on any foreign criminal watch list or is a known member of an organized crime ring. And that one goes on a little bit more, but we're going to jump to the next one. This one from the New York Sun. Arsenal is found at home of Columbia professor. An arsenal of weapons and explosive devices were found in the Brooklyn Heights apartment of a Columbia University professor yesterday morning after the professor's roommate accidentally shot himself. And they go through the cache of weapons and seeing if they're linked to any terrorist groups. And they mention again Klatz, Michael Klatz, was one of the first social scientists to undertake AIDS research in the early 1980s. Mr. Klatz had done studies for the National Institute on Drug Abuse, including one that was interrupted with the NDRI offices in the South Tower of the World Trade Center were destroyed in the terrorist attacks of 9/11. So where there we got, you know, early AIDS research, 9/11, and his roommate, Ivanov, made some reference to being involved with the Mossad. Now, I believe there's video of this. I haven't been able to find it, though. Jumping to the third article from the New York Times, weapons trove suspect is linked to hate crimes. Now we're getting a little more into it. It all happened in less than 3 hours on a cool September night, a prolific spurt of anti-Jewish vandalism at more than a dozen locations in the heart of Brooklyn Heights. On Monday, the police caught a break, arresting a man who they said had a trove of weapons inside a stately apartment building in the neighborhood. The man, Ivalo Ivanov, admitted under videotape questioning that he was behind the spree, which had mystified investigators for months. Later Monday evening, after Mr. Ivanov's arraignment in Brooklyn Criminal Court, his lawyer surprised reporters with his own announcement. Get ready! He's Jewish. The revelation was the latest twist in a bizarre story that features a man who police said shot his own finger and a sizable weapons collection, including pipe bombs and a sawed-off shotgun, found in the apartment of one of Brooklyn's most exclusive neighborhoods and a prominent HIV/AIDS researcher and medical anthropologist who owns the apartment. The hate crimes had unsettled local residents, many of whom awoke on the morning of September 25th to find swastikas and other slurs scratched, scrawled, and spray-painted on cars, playgrounds, synagogues, and building facades. Crude flyers reading "Kill all Jews" were strewn about. At one point, 20 detectives were assigned to investigate the case, and though they zeroed in on a suspect almost from the start, there was not enough evidence to charge him. According to the police official, Mr. Ivanov said his acts of vandalism were a result of bad judgment and rage. So, you've got a prominent AIDS researcher, no doubt connected to military funding through a university, and you've got a guy spray painting swastikas who turns out to be Jewish. So who's who here? So this, I'm sure, will probably be one of those stories in the next few weeks. In the back of the paper, they'll mention, oh yeah, there was an informant involved, or oh yeah, yeah. However, okay, here's the one thing in the New York Times article, jumping a bit down into it. Much less is known about Mr. Ivanov. In court, his lawyer said that Mr. Ivanov is a linguist. The authorities are not sure of his age, saying he's either 37 or 31. Mr. Ivanov told the police that he was born in Sicily, raised in Bulgaria, and that he had been trained by Israel's intelligence agency, Mossad. He's been arrested in the past on charges that included petty larceny, according to the police, but the disposition of those cases was not available. And it's not clear how long he'd been living at 58 Remsen with Mr. Klatz. So you have him in court saying, I'm connected to Mossad. Now the only thing is, would someone really connected to Mossad or the CIA or any other black bag, black ops job come right out at the drop of a hat and say Mossad? Probably not. But maybe he's connected. The fourth article comes from the New York Post. Pipe bomb Nazi. The Brooklyn ex-con arrested for stashing an arsenal of weapons in his posh apartment confessed to another crime yesterday, blanketing his neighborhood with swastikas last fall. So those stories are all up on MediaMonarchy.com, and you can go down that rabbit hole. So they're all put together under the heading, are fake neo-Nazi Brooklyn bombers really Mossad provocateurs? Staying in New York, jumping back to Danger Room. New York City's subway spy cam network stuck in the station. New York City's plan to secure its subways with a next-generation surveillance network is getting more expensive by the second and slipping further and further behind schedule. A new report by the New York State Comptroller's Office reveals that the cost of the electronic security program has grown from $265 million to $450 million. 70%. Shortly after the 7/7 false flag London bombings, the Metropolitan Transit Authority, which oversees New York's mass transit system, signed a contract in 2005 with defense contractor Lockheed Martin to put in thousands of security cameras, electronic tripwires, and digitally controlled gates into New York's sprawling network of subways. The deal was inked just a few months after MTA chairman Peter Kalikow argued against, quote, wasting money on unproven technology. That kind of sounds like the future combat systems we mentioned earlier. So at the heart of the program was a network of surveillance cameras passing what they saw through a set of intelligent video algorithms designed to spot suspicious behavior, a bag left on the subway platform, a person jumping down to the tracks, a mob running up a down escalator. And I'm sure, you know, they don't mention the biometrics and face scanning cameras and all of that. The Lockheed entry on SourceWatch.org mentions, of course, that they're the largest arms manufacturer in the world, with an order book worth somewhere in the realm of $23 billion in military sales, including fighter and transport aircraft, missiles and space systems. And I believe they're probably even involved in maybe some election machines. From one nightmare to another, we're going to jump to opednews.com. for an article written by Sally Stride, and there's a couple articles that go along with this and new studies from Scientific American, but it's all about fluoride, the fluoride deception. 1945 human experiment predicts current fluoride ill effects. In 1945, dentists set out to prove that adding fluoride chemicals into public water supplies safely prevented children's tooth decay. The studies failed. But early fluoridationists ignore this inconvenient truth and forged ahead. Now with two-thirds of public water supplies fluoridated, Americans are fluoride overdosed and suffer from fluoride's toxic effects as cavity rates climb anyway. In 1955, 10 years into the experiment, researchers reported more bone defects, anemia, and earlier female menstruation in children purposefully dosed with sodium fluoride-laced drinking water. This from the 1956 Journal of the American Dental Association. This is the first and only fluoridation human health experiment, which was carried out on the entire population in the city of Newburgh, New York. Her article goes on to cite the aforementioned fluoride deception by Christopher Bryson. But there's another article from Paul Joseph Watson. Scientific study finds fluoride horror stories factual. Industrial byproduct consumed by millions of Americans lowers IQ and causes cancer. The establishment media will have to find a new tactic with which to ridicule those who oppose the fluoridation of water after a major new Scientific American report concluded that, quote, scientific attitudes toward fluoridation may be starting to shift. As new evidence emerges of the poison's link to disorders affecting teeth, bones, the brain, and the thyroid gland, as well as lowering IQ. Today, almost 60% of the U.S. population drinks fluoridated water, including residents of 46 of the nation's 50 largest cities, reports Scientific American's Dan Fagan. Fagan is an award-winning environmental reporter and director of New York University's Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program. Outside the U.S., fluoridation has spread to Canada, the U.K., Australia, New Zealand, and a few other countries. Critics of the practice have generally been dismissed as gadflies or zealots by mainstream researchers and public health agencies in those countries, as well as in the U.S. In other nations, however, water fluoridation is rare and controversial. Indeed, the zeitgeist for scoffing at those who spoke of the dangers of mass medicating the public against their will with fluoride was the deranged and paranoid character of General Ripper in the hit 1964 Peter Sellers Stanley Kubrick film Dr. Strangelove. But that stereotype is quickly fading as serious scientific research uncovers proof that all the horror stories about sodium fluoride told through the decades are essentially true. Now, we link up to the Scientific American study, and there's even a link to find out if your city's water supply is poisoned with the deadly fluoride. The Scientific American report is called Second Thoughts on Fluoride. It's up on sciam.com. New research indicates that a cavity-fighting treatment could be risky if overused. There's the water fluoridation entry on Wikipedia. It's the practice of adding fluoride compounds to the water with the intended purpose of reducing tooth decay in the general population. There's also the entry of the water fluoridation controversy. It refers to the ongoing debate over the safety of the addition of fluoride to public water supplies. Opponents of fluoridation argue that studies show a connection between fluoride and various health problems. Additionally, fluoridation opponents argue that fluoridating water is a compulsory mass medication that takes away an individual's right to choose whether to consent to medical treatment. They also point to a lack of quality research into its efficacy and safety. And so I mentioned The Fluoride Deception, the book, and there's also a film up on Google Video. I've played a little bit of that before when I hit the story about fluoride shortages a couple months ago on MediaMonarchy.com. But we're going to hit the fluoride segment of a little series up on YouTube called Esoteric Agenda. This is part 5, Fluoride.
66% of United States residents' public water is fluoridated. It is known to have tremendous effects on bone cancer, joint problems, bone weakness, lowered estrogen and testosterone levels, and dental fluorosis, which is yellowing of the teeth and pitting in the enamel. Wouldn't it make more sense to enhance public water with vitamins, which are meant to be ingested, to promote overall health, rather than putting such a toxic chemical in our water with a bogus explanation that it will improve our dental health? We now know that fluoride causes more dental problems than it solves. Something doesn't seem right about this. Do you honestly believe that these companies care deeply enough for the people to spend large amounts of their own money to fluoridate public water when the people already purchase their own toothpaste? But there's a difference between toothpaste and drinking water. We don't ingest toothpaste. If you go to any hardware store and look at any rat poison product, you will only find one ingredient: sodium fluoride. It is the most toxic ionic molecule outside of potassium dichromate. Now Danone, along with other companies, have begun fluoridating bottled water. It is becoming increasingly difficult to get away from. And the fact that fluoride is also used in many prescription antidepressants shows that it eliminates aggression and motivation in people.
Fluoride, to my knowledge as a physician, has absolutely no biological benefit whatsoever.
But one of the significant things is that the Russians carried out all sorts of experiments on the people living in the Gulag. One of them, of course, was to fluoridate the water. Why? You fluoridate the water, why people are not as aggressive as they ordinarily would be. In fact, what is the active ingredient in Prozac that is so widely distributed in America today? Why, it's a fluoride compound.
And now, we are finding that public water nationwide is showing up with arsenic, lead, cadmium, and thermonium, which is a radioactive form of lead. Aspartame, the artificial sweetener found in almost every low-sugar or sugar-free product on the market.
First of all, aspartame is made up of three things: methanol, which of course is what produces blindness, aspartic acid, and phenylalanine. These are all poisons. Aspartic acid, of course, produces brain lesions. This was known back in the early 1970s. Methanol produces blindness. Phenylalanine is what you see certain in the brain, and in high doses it produces trauma.
We're not making this all up. The FDA did publish back in, I think it was in 18.
1980, they did publish the 92 potential side effects of aspartame. And they do, these side effects are quite extremely serious. Things like dizziness, problems with balance, abdominal pain and cramps, changes in vision, seizures and convulsions, etc.
Yet despite all of these harmful effects, Donald Rumsfeld pushed it out into the stores in over 5,000 products when he was CEO of Searly, the company that manufactured aspartame.
And what a great little segue into more news about Donald Rumsfeld. So they just mentioned that, of course, Donald Rumsfeld is one of the men behind aspartame when he was involved with what they just referred to as Searly. I've heard it called Searle. It's S-E-R-L-E. And so that was part five of Esoteric Agenda with their fluoride segment. And like I said, that segues into our new news about Ronald Rumsfeld. Coming from Danger Room yet again, Rummy resurfaces and calls for a U.S. propaganda agency. Thanks, Rummy. One of the many things I love about Donald Rumsfeld is that he's totally unrepentant. Back in 2001, the Pentagon, under his leadership, created the controversial Office of Strategic Influence, OSI, which was closed down just a few months later after its existence became public. I'm sure it was just moved somewhere else and its name was changed. Rightly or wrongly, the Pentagon was accused of creating a propaganda office. Now, the former defense secretary has a bigger vision. He's advocating a, quote, 21st century agency for global communications. This was one of the major themes in one of Rumsfeld's first post-Pentagon public comments at a conference yesterday, or rather 2 days ago, on network-centric warfare sponsored by the Institute for Defense and Government Advancement. According to Rumsfeld, the United States is losing the war of ideas in the Muslim world, and the answer to that is in part through the creation of this new government agency. So during the Q&A after the speech, Rumsfeld was asked what this new agency might entail. He was pretty clear it wouldn't be a resurrected U.S. information agency, which was merged into the State Department in 1999, and why, when there's such an abundance of media available in the private sector, the government needs to get involved. Rumsfeld speaks for himself and says, "Private media does not get up in the morning and say what we can do to promote the values and ideas of that free Western nation we believe in." And he says lots of other garbage, too. The update from Danger Room is that websites such as Mountain Runner, Intel Fusion, Spencer Ackerman, and even the Washington Post's William Arkin all weigh in on the Office OSI. There's one from the AirForceTimes.com. Rumsfeld says, "Ramp up information warfare," and that's basically what it is. So the Office of Strategic Influence, I couldn't get it out there a second ago, or OSI, was a department created by the DOD on October 30th, 2001, to support the War of Terror through psychological operations in targeted countries. The closure of the office was announced by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld soon after its existence became publicly known. Yet, there's the party line again. The OSI would have been a center for the creation of propaganda materials for the stated purpose of misleading enemy forces or foreign civilian populations. And you can read more about black ops and psychological operations in Fort Bragg and all that under Rummy Resurfaces. Speaking of propaganda, we've got more coming from Shrub. This coming from RogueGovernment.com. Bush establishes Financial Propaganda Council. So Lee Rogers writing says, "The amount of insanity coming out of the United States government has reached a new level. George W. Bush has issued a new executive order establishing a group called the, quote, President's Advisory Council on Financial Literacy. The insanity of this executive order is unparalleled. The so-called purpose of this council is to keep the nation economically competitive and encourage the financial literacy of the American people. The government, working in conjunction with the Federal Reserve, has done everything in their power since the implementation of the Federal Reserve to ensure that the American people know nothing about how our monetary system really works. It's interesting that in light of major financial problems and an increased awareness of the Federal Reserve amongst the American people that we see the formation of such a council." This group is not going to educate the American people about how the financial system actually works. If they did, they would be forced to admit that the Federal Reserve creates money out of thin air that has no value. The establishment's not going to do that. Instead, this group will be used to spread propaganda about the economy, mislead the American people as to what's really creating all the financial problems, and provide phony solutions to these problems. This group may even go so far as saying that we need to replace the U.S. dollar with a regional currency. The bottom line is that the government has continuously lied about everything, so why should we listen to this newly formed council? Not only that, but the government and the Federal Reserve are the ones that really need an educational lesson on monetary policy because they're the ones who have been destroying the economy through fiat currency. Endless foreign wars and expanding the money supply was what destroyed Rome. And they're doing the exact same thing, and if it's continued, it will result in our doom. Lee Rogers' article on Bush's Financial Propaganda Council up on roguegovernment.com goes through the different segments and steps of this executive order, and I even link over to whitehouse.gov, executive order establishing the President's Advisory Council on Financial Literacy, so you can read all of it, again, from the fascist mouth. But what ties all this together? We need sometimes to go back to the days of yesteryear when we used to sit in a classroom, the lights would go down, and the clankety-clank of the projector would fire up, and we would learn a little bit about propaganda techniques.
Was it really a victory for good government, Mr. Brown? Or was it a victory for propaganda?
That's quite a question.
Well, we've been studying citizenship in school. In a few years, I'll start voting. I've been following the campaign. So much was said on both sides, I'm confused. How can you know what to believe when there's so much propaganda?
Perhaps I can help you, Chuck. I think it might also be called a victory for propaganda. But that would have been equally true if our opponent had won.
But that's what I mean. Everybody uses propaganda.
Oh, no, not everybody, Chuck. I've been studying it for some years. Propaganda made this picture. Propaganda skillfully employed to turn millions of men to a cruel hatred of their fellow men. On the other hand, propaganda often persuades us to help our fellow men. The products of our factories are also known around the world through propaganda in the form of advertising and salesmanship. The study of history reveals a great deal of propaganda that has been used to fight wars and win wars. Propaganda can also be used for peace.
So you see, Chuck, propaganda is important. Well worth any time you give studying it. I see that. But how can you study it?
Well, you can begin by investigating the techniques of propaganda. Here, I've listed some of the main ones. Glittering generalities, transfer, name-calling, card stacking, testimonial, plain folks, and bandwagon. You'll find these techniques used in many places, in many ways, for many different purposes. Your job is to recognize them when you see them.
My first job is to understand what they mean. What is a glittering generality?
Well, let me see. That headline you were quoting, A Victory for Good Government. Good government is a phrase we use many times during the campaign. We said the mayor stood for good government and promised good government.
But it's true, isn't it?
What's true?
What does good government mean?
Is the mayor's idea of good government the same as yours?
I see. It's a glittering generality.
One of the best.
There's another.
Yes. And why do you suppose our opponents chose that phrase?
I guess because everybody likes a real American.
Right. And they wanted to transfer that liking for a real American to Mr. Butler.
And that's what you mean by the technique of transfer.
That's it. Now let's see if you can recognize another technique. A day or so after that poster came out, I said in one of my campaign speeches, our opponent advertises himself as a real American. I say he is unreal, unrealistic. He is a visionary, a theorist, a dreamer.
he is so thirsty for public office that like a weary traveler in the desert, he sees a mirage, and he is trying to sell it to you as real.
There. Now, what would you call that?
That's name-calling, visionary, theorist, dreamer.
That's right. And those are very polite names. But now I want you to listen to something else. For my collection of propaganda materials, I've made a special record of part of one of Mr. Butler's radio speeches.
Mayor Cooper asks that he be judged by his performance in office. Very well. Let's ask him who was mayor when the municipal waterworks fell into such a state of disrepair that the whole town was without water for 2 days. Let's ask him. But no, let's not. It might embarrass him.
You recognize the technique?
No, I don't.
It's a tricky one.
Is it true about the waterworks?
Partly true. That's what we call card stacking. Cooper was mayor when the pumping station broke down, but it was the men in office before him who allowed it to get into such a rundown condition, and it finally gave way before he could get anything done.
I see. And card stacking is choosing some facts and leaving out others and arranging them to suit your purpose.
That's the idea.
That's the idea. A bandana full of glittering generalities. That's just a little bit of the film strip Propaganda Techniques. It's up on YouTube and MediaMonarchy.com. I should tell you, you're listening to episode 60 of MediaMonarchy.com, coming to you live January 25th, 2008, from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and the Revere Radio Network, revereradio.info. Tons more news still to get through. I'm going to have to pick it up. This coming from Threat Level, Montana Governor foments real ID rebellion. Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer declared independence last Friday from federal identification rules and called on governors of 17 other states to join him in forcing a showdown with the federal government and Homeland Security, which says it will not accept the driver's licenses of rebel states starting May 11th. That's the date that Real ID kicks in. If that showdown comes to pass, a resident of a non-complying state could not use a driver's license to enter a federal courthouse or a Social Security Administration building, nor could he board a plane without undergoing a pat-down search, possibly creating massive backlogs at the nation's airports and almost certainly leading to a flurry of federal lawsuits. States have until May 11th to request extensions to the Real ID rules that were released last Friday. They require states to make all current identification holders under the age of 50 to apply again with certified birth and marriage certificates. The rules standardize license formats, require states to interlink their DMV databases, and require DMV employees to undergo background checks. Montana last year passed a law saying it would not comply, citing privacy, states' rights, and fiscal issues. So let the Real ID rebellion begin. Brian Schweitzer's Wikipedia entry mentions that he is perhaps, or rather, Schweitzer currently has one of the highest gubernatorial approval ratings in the nation, with polls regularly showing a rating of around 70%. So that's Brian Schweitzer of Montana. Jumping to the UK, the telegraph.co.uk, random breathalyzer tests planned for motorists. Motorists face being subjected to random breath testing as part of the biggest shakeup of drink drive law since the introduction of the breathalyzer 40 years ago. Ministers are convinced that tougher enforcement is the key to cutting the number of alcohol-related road deaths. Their plans for random testing will be unveiled within weeks. Police can currently carry out a breath test only if a motorist has been driving erratically, been involved in an accident, or committed another offense while driving, such as having a faulty taillight or speeding. The proposed changes would allow breath tests to be carried out at any time, with roadside checkpoints being set up at points where police were confident they could catch lawbreakers. Think of it as a breath trap. And there's the Wikipedia link. You can read more about the breathalyzer and its history and uses. But we're going to jump to the Huffington Post, Dateline Jerusalem. Israel launches advanced spy satellite. Israel launched an advanced spy satellite Monday that will be able to track events in Iran, the country it considers its top foe this week, even at night and in cloudy weather. The Texar, T-E-C-S-A-R, satellite is of particular importance for Israel because it can be used to keep tabs on Iran's nuclear program, which the U.S. and Israel fear is a cover for pursuing nuclear weapons. The satellite, developed by Israel Aerospace Industries, operates with a special radar system, allowing it to view much more than existing OFEC satellites that use cameras. And there's a little video that I have linked up that I got from the Jerusalem Post about Iran delayed their shuttle launch. The successful launch on Monday of an advanced Israeli satellite was delayed in recent months by those Iranians. It was Iranian sabotage. The Texar satellite, developed and manufactured by IAI, like I just told you, it's those damn Iranians. So that video is up there, up on MediaMonarchy.com and YouTube.com/MediaMonarchy. I'm also linked up to read about the Texar, also known as Polaris. It's a reconnaissance satellite, and it's floating around above you now. Another one from the AFP, this one from Breitbart.com. Global elite, well, that they don't say global elite, that's what we say. But the global elite headed to Davos, Switzerland, as chilly winds whip up world economy. So they're putting a light touch to that. Basically, the oligarchs and globalists are going to their World Economic Forum in Davos to figure out what the fuck they're going to do about the collapsing economies around the world. I mean, they want to break it down, but perhaps it's going a little fast. The icy Swiss mountains are host to the world's business and political elite this week for their annual gathering in Davos, where the cooling temperature of the world economy is set to focus minds. Started in 1971 and known as the World Economic Forum, the gathering provides a unique opportunity to gauge the blah-blah-blah of people like Hamid Karzai, who used to work for Unocal, Israel Shimon Peres, and you got, of course, Bill Gates and Ban Ki-moon of the Moonies, current UK Prime Minister Gordon New World Order Brown, you got Condoleezza Rice, and I think even our hero Bono was there. And so you can read about the World Economic Forum and all the banksters and gangsters and movers and shakers involved in that, but we're going to jump again to the Telegraph for something called the Black Pope. New Black Pope has been appointed, elected, selected by the Jesuits. A little-known Spanish priest who has spent his entire life in Asia among the poor has been elected to lead the Jesuits, the Catholic Church's largest religious order. Father Adolfo Nicolás was chosen by 217 electors as the new Black Pope. The nickname derives from the power and influence he will wield, as well as from the simple black garments he will wear. So you have the White Pope and the power he wields, and then you have the Black Pope and the power he wields. And the links are there, and you can read all about it, and the Jesuits, and Vatican Assassins, and the Black Pope, and Hans Peter Kolvenbach, and more. But speaking of crashing world economies, last Monday, while the U.S. markets were closed for Martin Luther King Day, the world stock market plummeted for their worst day since 9/11. The FTSE 100 index, and we'll read about that in a moment, plummeted 323.5 points, its biggest one-day drop since 9/11. The FTSE 100 nosedived by 5.5% as fears of a U.S. recession sparked a global sell-off. Shares across Europe also dived, and Asian stock markets suffered heavy overnight losses as fears of the health of the world's biggest economy swept through markets across the globe.
European shares sank 5.6% by midday on Monday, threatening their worst one-day fall since the attacks of September 2001, as investors rattled by the specter of a U.S. recession dumped stocks across the board. The U.S. stock market is closed for a holiday. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown, who is touring India, proposed turning the IMF into an independent watchdog that would form the heart of a global warning system against financial turbulence. European banking analyst at Bear Stearns, Chris Wheeler, said it may be a case of shutting the stable door after the horse has bolted.
And the FTSE 100, or the top 100 shares and stocks traded on the London Stock Exchange, And that little report from Reuters is up on MediaMonarchy.com. Jumping to China and their upcoming Beijing Summer Olympics this summer, 2008. This coming from The Australian, China hushes up Olympic deaths. China has systematically covered up the accidental deaths of at least 10 workers and perhaps many more in a rush to construct the futuristic Bird's Nest Stadium in Beijing for this summer's Olympic Games. The estimates are drawn from dozens of interviews conducted over 6 months under a guarantee of anonymity with employees from the huge building site in the northern district of the capital. Witnesses have told the Sunday Times of seeing workers plummet to their deaths from the perilous heights of the stadium, which was designated by a consortium including ARUP, A-R-U-P, the British engineering firm, and Herzog and de Meuron, the Swiss architects. And there's links to their websites, and you can even see some photos of this crazy Bird's Nest Stadium. But if we jump to the 2008 Summer Olympics entry, jump on down to concerns and controversy. You can read all about the coming controversies of China's Summer Olympics and their human rights problems and their Tibet problems and their seeding the clouds and their weather wars to try and make the Summer Olympics go well. It's all there and you can all read about it. Just one of the many reasons why MediaMonarchy.com is banned in China, according to the great firewall of China.org. But we're going to jump to my man Alex Ansari and his show Outside the Box. I'm lining up Alex. Should be coming on the show pretty soon. And so I'll have Alex Ansari here in studio with the Portland Radio Authority coming up on MediaMonarchy.com. But his latest episode of Outside the Box is 136. He also has his show on We the People Radio Network on Saturdays, WTPRN.com. But on the TV show, he covers the breaking developments of the cloning of cattle for human consumption. Yum. The microchip implant, which is what we're going to hear about, the Real ID Act of 2008, and the new Server in the Sky project. And I added the link so you can read about the Server in the Sky, but let's listen to Alex Ansari talk about the microchip.
Now, I'll take a pause here. People have been talking about implantable microchips for many, many years. It goes back even into the 1970s and 1960s. People were also talking about a Rambo chip that was used in Vietnam that would boost adrenaline to the soldier fighting on the battlefield. In terms of forced implantable microchips being pushed on the populations at large, other than people having to take the chip to work in secure facilities in Mexico, and there's been a couple other stories, a lot of stories about voluntary microchip use and application, it has not been until now that we've talked about prisoners officially, admittedly, being chipped to track their location. British prisoners will soon be chipped like dogs. From the Independent in the UK, officials in the UK are planning to implant microchips under the skin of thousands of offenders as part of an expansion of the electronic tagging scheme that would, as they say, create more space in British jails. The Ministry of Justice is now investigating the use of satellite and radio wave technology to monitor criminals. Instead of an ankle bracelet, the chip will be surgically inserted under the skin of offenders in the community to help enforce home curfews. RFID tags, about the size of 2 grains of rice, they've also been described as about the size of 1 gram of rice, a grain of rice, are able to carry scannable personal information by individuals, including their identities, address, and offending record. Chips are also being considered as a method of helping to keep order within the prisons. Some of you may remember the 60 Minute clip where they talked about the implantable microchip and its possible application in prisons, even implantable microchips for those on probation. A shock or a jolt saying, don't do something wrong when you think of something that could be determined to be illegal or wrong, according to the state. You may laugh and say, this technology should stay on the sci-fi channel. It was talked about in the post-9/11 world, talking about security, keeping us safe from ourselves, right after the 9/11 attacks. So this is where we are today. The number of prisoners held in police cells rose 13-fold last year, with police stations housing offenders more than 60,000 times in 2007, up from 4,600 the previous year. So more things they put on the books that are illegal, the more people they pack into the Supermax prisons. The sad reality is that hackers can easily clone the binary code and information contained on the chip with the right know-how. There's been a couple different things with the microchip. This report comes to us from the Canadian. Doctor alleges plans underway to microchip newborns in the United States and Europe. As you'll find out later on the broadcast, there's a lot that's coming that's going to connect the United States and Europe economically, judicially, through a wide variety of other forms of legislation that are being passed at the same time here in Congress and in the European Union. Regarding plans to microchip newborns, Dr. Kyle said the U.S. has been moving in this direction in secrecy. She added that in Sweden, Prime Minister Ulf Palme gave permission in the year 1973 to implant prisoners, and Data Inspection's ex-director general, Jean Frese, has revealed that nursing home patients were implanted in the mid-1980s. The technologies were revealed in the 1972-47 Swedish state report, and I can't pronounce this, Statens Officiella Utrogonger. Are you prepared now to live in a world where every newborn baby is microchipped? And are you ready to have your every move tracked, recorded, and placed in a Big Brother data bank? According to the Finnish article, distributed to doctors and medical students, time is now running out for changing the direction of military medicine and mind control technology, ensuring the freedom and future of humanity. When you talk about a microchip, we're not just talking about tracking. This is the reality that a lot of people have a hard time grasping. It's about monitoring what's going on in your body and your thoughts. And a signal works both ways. When you learn about the technology of the microchip, it works both ways. To monitor and to alter or influence. And this can even be done now without the chip. Once you learn about mind reading technologies and go beyond HARP, you're entering another ballpark.
That's Alex Ansari from Outside the Box, episode 136, talking about the microchip. Then we're going to jump into our last blast of news, putting the media back in the monarchy, all about stuff in the media, film, television, magazines. So first, it's a war online, as of now. This coming again from Threat Level. War breaks out between hackers and Scientology, a loose confederation of online troublemakers who call themselves Anonymous, have declared war on the Church of Scientology by flooding its servers with fake data requests, describing the attacks as punishment for the church's alleged abuse of copyright laws and alleged brainwashing of its members. Anonymous congregates on the net at various hangouts such as 711chan.org and partyvan.info and sundry IRC channels. The group usually amuses itself by stealing passwords to downloading sites and finding ways to harass online communities that its members disdain. They were last seen on Threat Level when a Los Angeles Fox News affiliate ran a story that hilariously implied the group's arsenal included exploding vans. The attack on Scientology, which Anonymous has dubbed Project Chanology, started in recent days, set off by the church's most recent attempt to censor the internet by forcing sites to remove a creepy Tom Cruise Scientology video, which we covered last week on Media Monarchy. A wiki set up for the project directs Anonymous members to download and use denial-of-service software, make prank phone calls, host Scientology documents the church considers proprietary, and fax endless loops of black pages to the church's fax machines to waste ink.
Hello, leaders of Scientology. We are Anonymous. Over the years, we have been watching you, your campaigns of misinformation, your suppression of dissent, your litigious nature. All of these things have caught our eye. With the leakage of your latest propaganda video into mainstream circulation, the extent of your malign influence over those who have come to trust you as leaders has been made clear to us. Anonymous has therefore decided that your organization should be destroyed, for the good of your followers, for the good of mankind, and for our own enjoyment. We shall proceed to expel you from the internet and systematically dismantle the Church of Scientology in its present form. We recognize you as serious opponents, and do not expect our campaign to be completed in a short time frame. However, you will not prevail forever against the angry masses of the body politic. Your choice of methods, your hypocrisy, and the general artlessness of your organization have sounded its death knell. You have nowhere to hide, because we are everywhere. You will find no recourse in attack. because for each of us that falls, 10 more will take his place. We are cognizant of the many who may decry our methods as parallel to those of the Church of Scientology. Those who espouse the obvious truth that your organization will use the actions of Anonymous as an example of the persecution of which you have for so long warned your followers. This is acceptable to Anonymous. In fact, it is encouraged. We are your SPs. Over time, as we begin to merge our pulse with that of your church, the suppression of your followers will become increasingly difficult to maintain. Believers will become aware that salvation needn't come at the expense of their livelihood. They will become aware that the stress and the frustration that they feel is not due to us, but a source much closer to them. Yes, we are SPs, but the sum of suppression we could ever muster is eclipsed by that of your own RTC. Knowledge is free. We are Anonymous. We are Legion. We do not forgive. We do not forget. Expect us.
Next, the stories most debated online today. One of the most discussed is hackers versus Scientology. A group calling themselves Anonymous has vowed to destroy the Church of Scientology.
When you drive past an accident, it's not like anyone else. I've passed, you know you have to do something about it because you know you're the only one that can really help.
Well, they claim to be reacting to Scientology's decision to try and ban this now infamous video of Tom Cruise. In return, they've posted their own video threatening action against the church, and they claim to have taken down the Scientology website. Well, it's all very ominous, but what can they do about that claim? And should we be worried that an unknown group of hackers has this kind of power? We're turning to Alan Phillips, who's chief executive of computer security firm 7Safe. Are they bluffing, Alan, or could they do this?
There are many different things that computer hackers, as they get termed, can do. It would appear that in this case, they've taken down the website by using what they call a denial of service attack, where they basically fire lots and lots of different packets or bits of information into the one place, so it makes it inoperable, so no one else can access it. But, you know, there are many other things that people with computer security knowledge can do. It might be that they actually look on the website and look for some kind of vulnerability that they can exploit.
If I'm the victim of a DOS, a denial of service attack, what would you advise one of your clients to do to sort of get around it?
Well, the denial of service attack, or the distributed denial of service attack, is actually quite a difficult thing to stop, because you have suddenly, out of the blue, a whole bunch of machines all accessing the same machine, and well, you know, it's like trying to get too many people onto a bus. You can't do anything about it. So
there is that clog at the doors. It's literally like that.
Yeah, it's pretty much exactly the same kind of thing.
But can it be maintained indefinitely, or can people do something about these incoming extra people, to continue our metaphor?
Well, over time, you can sort of have a look at it. Can be a bit of a laborious process, but you can see which machines are actually doing the denial of servicing, and you can, you know, filter them out. But it tends to be that these kind of things happen for a sustained period, then disappear, and then another bunch of machines start the attack.
Right, which is why they prove so effective, I suppose.
Well, it's difficult, as I said, this particular kind of attack, because if you've got an online presence and say you're selling something, basically time is money, so every minute you're down.
Sure.
And quite often the criminal gangs, if you like, actually target these sites, like the betting sites have been targeted, you probably recall from a couple of years ago, and they ask them to pay ransom money. So, I mean, in some occasions that happens as well.
You've actually heard cases where that's been handed over?
Yes.
What? Deceased, we'll keep doing this unless you give us money, and people have actually handed over?
Yeah, because...
But, I mean, that must be on the promise of absolutely nothing, surely.
Well, if they're paying the money, that's actually less money than they would be making while they're online.
I suppose it's worth
sensible.
It. You're seeing the moral code of this coming away from the electronics of it. This is a site that's who attack Scientology. Many of those people are split by this. It's morally wrong, they say, in this particular argument, and you can see the URL on screen there, to use this kind of anonymous blogging or anonymous attacking. There is a kind of creed of behaviour online, isn't there? And many people disapprove of this kind of attack.
Well, in this particular case, I think it seems to be some kind of grudge. So, I mean, people who have grudges don't really seem to follow a code of ethics, so...
That's a little bit about Anonymous versus the Church of Scientology from Sky News. It's up on MediaMonarchy.com. Moving to our next article from Kurt Nemo, TruthNews.us. Globalists want attacks on TV and video games. David Rockefeller, Maurice Strong, and the Earth Summit folks, including the United Nations Environmental Program, want to tax your television and video games. The Sierra Club is proposing a tax on video games and television, with the proceeds going to programs that encourages families to get off the couch and into the mountains, reports KOB New Mexico, with a link to their story. Mike Casas of the Sierra Club says families hiking a mountain trail together are becoming scarce as childhood diabetes and obesity is soaring, which is why the organization is proposing the 1% tax. In other words, you're too stupid and lazy to do anything about your diabetes and obesity, and yet another tax will get you motivated. Of course, the state doesn't care if you're overweight or have bad teeth, as the aforementioned fluoride. It simply is looking for yet another excuse to fleece you. Mike Casas of the Sierra Club might be distressed at the lack of mountain hikers, but you can bet the people behind the Sierra Club couldn't care less. It's all about the global agenda, not your waistline.
It's a tax designed to get kids off the couch and into nature, and it's aimed straight for one of their favorite pastimes, video games and TV. Gotti Schwartz shows us what supporters of the tax hope to accomplish. Gotti.
Well, for about $49, you can spend unlimited time blasting away in front of the tube, but some say for 1% of what this costs, you can make the difference from this living room to a mountain.
Come on, I'll wait for you.
Finally out exploring the foothills.
So right here's us.
Hey, Dad, VIP.
Right.
Tom Mack says he's been waiting all day to get his kids outside.
We were looking up pictures of, what were we looking up pictures of today?
Bobcats, mountain lions, and cougars.
Right, yeah, and so they get to learn about the outdoors and get to appreciate nature.
Well, I like seeing real flowers and butterflies and all those birds and all those things.
The Sierra Club says families like the Max are getting harder to find.
Childhood obesity is going up in New Mexico and across the country, in addition to increased rates of diabetes and attention deficit disorders.
That's why Michael Casaus is helping put together a bill for this legislative session aimed at slapping a 1% tax on video games and televisions.
What we'd like to do with this excise tax on televisions and video games and video game equipment is to tax part of the problem to fund the solution.
We took the idea to Gamers Anonymous, a local video game store.
And I have no problem with the idea of kids, you know, going out and doing something, you know, fairly proactive, if that's what they're into.
You know, you can tax it, you can ban it, but when it comes down to it, if your kid is playing 12 hours a day and you're not doing anything about it, it's your fault.
But tax or no tax, they say there will always be kids more inclined to staying inside, something even little Caitlin can vouch for. This evening, her brother is missing the mountains.
He's there playing video games right now, so he don't want to come.
If the bill passes, it's expected to bring in about $4 million. The Sierra Club says that money would be funneled back into programs like outdoor classrooms that teach children about the outdoors. Last year, lawmakers killed the idea.
More taxes. But blasting through our last bit of media news, another note about where in the world is Osama bin Laden, my man from my home state. And even in the right, we went to the same mall. Me and Morgan Spurlock, we went to the Crossroads Mall in Beckley, West Virginia. However, he has one of the most highly anticipated films at Sundance, and I do not. His new movie is Where in the World is Osama bin Laden? He went to Afghanistan and all around the Middle East and shot tons and tons and tons of footage in search of the elusive supposed 9/11 mastermind. It's all interesting. It's all a big psyop. It's all about Emmanuel Goldstein and the boogeyman that doesn't really exist. And if you link on over from that story and go to the FBI's page and look at the wanted poster of Osama bin Laden, you'll, of course, see that there's no mention of 9/11 on Osama bin Laden's wanted poster because the FBI, as I've mentioned, has, quote, no hard evidence connecting bin Laden to 9/11. Jumping to click2houston.com, and it's the Borat to Supreme Court of Alabama. High fives! The etiquette teacher, has been ruled against by the Alabama Supreme Court. The etiquette teacher in the movie Borat claims the scene humiliated her, but she signed the release form, so tough noogies. jumping to torrentfreak.com, RIAA website wiped clean by hackers. Apparently, the RIAA is so busy suing consumers that they forgot to hire a decent programmer. With a simple SQL injection, all their propaganda has been successfully wiped from the site. It started out on the social news website Reddit, where a link to a really slow SQL query was posted. While the Reddit users were trying to kill the RIAA server, someone allegedly decided to up the ante and wipe the site's entire database. And all the links are there, and you can see how it ties into the Pirate Bay and all that. Jumping to afterdowningstreet.org, this is a scholarly report from the Massachusetts School of Law. It's written by David Swanson. It's called Hollywood Cashes In on War Movies Despite Opposition, quote-unquote, to war. Hollywood may oppose war, but it has cashed in handsomely from the 3,000 war-related films it's churned out since 39. 21 of them Oscar winners for Best Picture, a noted economist says. Where bomb and bullet makers must seize their profits while the fighting is hot, writes David Witten of Auburn University, Alabama, movie makers can cash in on a war forever after, and they do. Hollywood, for all its outspokenness against war, created war's popular image. The overwhelming majority of modern citizens know nothing about the military other than what they've seen on the electronic and silver screens. Few have firsthand experience with it. And there is a link to the long-term view, which is the journal put out by the Massachusetts School of Law at Andover, with the article Cinematastics, the Cosmetic Face of War, but you have to buy it, so you can't read the whole thing, but I've got the portions for you. Jumping to AlleyInsider.com, Silicon Alley Insider, Walmart gives the New Yorker and Forbes, Fortune, BizWeek, etc., the boot. And it mentions how Walmart is kicking out about 1,000 magazines from their racks. And some of the delusional magazine industry types rationalize that this could be good for business. But make no mistake, this is a disaster for the magazine world, which depends on Walmart for an estimated 20% of its retail sales. Jumping to Reuters, this almost made me happy for a second, but I'm not getting my hopes up. Oliver Stone to make a fair movie about George W. Bush. Director Oliver Stone, who's made movies about Presidents John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon, is developing a project about the current occupant of the White House, but promises it will not be a hatchet job. So this originates from Variety.com. Josh Brolin is set to star as George H.W. Bush in Oliver Stone's forthcoming movie, Bush. And now he's working with the same hacks that created World Trade Center. So any hopes of Oliver Stone being like his old days of JFK probably aren't going to come true. So finally today on this 60th episode of MediaMonarchy.com, I mentioned at the very top of the show, and we played a track called MK Ultra by the Black Rebel Motorcycle Club. I want to talk a little bit about MK Ultra and how it relates to a guy named Dr. Donald Ewan Cameron. And there's a little piece from Frontline Scotland about Ewan Cameron, the memory thief.
Ewan Cameron, a Scottish psychiatrist with a desire to become a scientific legend. His groundbreaking research in the 1950s hoped to find a cure for serious mental illness, but Dr. Cameron stepped over the line. Secretly funded by the CIA, he brainwashed unsuspecting patients. 5 decades later, some are only now receiving compensation. This is the story of Dr. Ewan Cameron and the patients whose memories he stole. Perched high on a hill above the Canadian city of Montreal is the Allen Memorial Institute. It was inside this building Dr. Ewan Cameron's bizarre story began. Here, he created a radical program of psychiatric research. 50 years later, former patients are still struggling to cope with their time in the Allen.
I have nightly nightmares where I wake up screaming. I hear myself screaming. And it was a repeated nightmare where I see a tall man, and then I have this feeling of a cold on my forehead, which I later learned is the jelly applied where the electrodes go, and I feel the electricity going through my body, and people are holding me down, and then I wake up screaming. This is very vivid.
Our research discovered that Ewan Cameron's journey to the top of his profession began in Bridge of Allen. He was born in 1901, the son of a Presbyterian minister. He went to Glasgow University. After graduating in 1924, Cameron moved to North America, where he quickly established himself.
His reputation was very high. He was a pillar of psychiatry in North America. He had a tremendous reputation. He had been president of the American Psychiatric Association, the Canadian Psychiatric Association. He was a... Well, it was like a laird.
By the mid-1940s, Cameron's reputation had spread far beyond the shores of North America. At the end of the Second World War, he assessed whether the infamous Nazi doctor Rudolf Hess could stand trial at Nuremberg. Cameron was a man in demand.
These are the days, and ours are the occasions. And it is...
The former Glasgow University graduate was to become the first head of the World Psychiatric Association. He was appointed founding director of the Allen Memorial Institute in 1943. It was Cameron's kingdom and became one of the leading psychiatric centers in the world.
He was extraordinarily charismatic. He was a real striver. He was an opinion maker and leader.
Canadian author Anne Collins has written a book on Cameron and his work. She says, in the beginning, he was a man to be admired for his pioneering approach to psychiatric patients. He was enjoying almost godlike status.
That's just a little bit of The Memory Thief about Dr. Donald Ewan Cameron, who was involved in experiments in Canada for Project MK-Ultra, a United States-based CIA-directed mind control program. And I was going to read a little bit about Ewan Cameron from Sinister Forces, Book 1, Peter Lavenda's book that I'm reading through, and amazingly enough, every week has something pertinent I want to read from, but I've run out of time, and that's going to do it for this 60th episode of Media Monarchy, coming to you January 25th, 2008. From the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and from the Revere Radio Network, revereradio.info. And you can hit me up on MySpace, Yahoo, Dig, YouTube, with Media Monarchy as your keyword, as well as hit up podcasts from iTunes, radioforall.net, and archive.org. Lastly, as I like to do at the end of each episode, is give a little rundown of some of the creepy and interesting visitors to MediaMonarchy.com through the week. This last week, we had the Tennessee Technological University. We had the CIA-connected Booz Allen and Hamilton hit Media Monarchy after they Googled Ron Paul's South Carolina debate video. We had Carroll College in Helena, Montana. They Googled Media Monarchy. The Milwaukee County Federated Library System hit me up for my link on sourcewatch.org on the entry about Dick Cheney. We had the Refugee Review Tribunal Google Idi Amin. We had the Weyeth Arist Research. We had CBS Google China Cover-Up Bodies Olympics. We had the Carnegie Mellon University Google Unanswered Questions About AT&T Breakdown. Someone at Carroll College in Helena, Montana, the aforementioned, Googled Media Monarchy. The Canadian Dental Association Googled Monkey Mind, which we went over last week, the monkey brain controlling a robot. We also had the Cal Poly State University Googled Attack on Scientology. We had Prairie View A&M University in Texas. We had Microsoft out of Washington Googling fingerprinting SeaTac Iranian travelers. That's the Seattle-Tacoma Airport fingerprinting Iranian travelers. The DEA visited MediaMonarchy.com twice. We had the Joint Analysis Center in London Google Prescott Bush coup BBC. Boeing, our favorite private military contractor, hit me up from my link on roguegovernment.com. Rupert Murdoch's News Corps was reading about Osama bin Laden's new daughter-in-law. the Navy Network Information Center, googled Clear Channel Romney, and of course, as we mentioned in previous episodes, Mitt Romney and his private equity firm Bain Capital have bought Clear Channel. Northrop Grumman hit me from SourceWatch on their own entry of Northrop Grumman. Navy Network Information Center again googled Navy Solid Curtain. And finally, the New Jersey State Library were reading about the fake Brooklyn Nazis or Mossad provocateurs. So that's going to do it. I love doing it for you. It keeps me going. Send me an email at MediaMonarchy@Yahoo.com. And tell me how you listen to the show, if you listen to the show, if you like it or love it or hate it. Please help me out. Pass the show along. Add a link on your page. Hit me up on MySpace. Something. Because like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
Police would get him just the same.